Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, February 26, 2017, and this is show number 616. Well, this week's Chit Chat Across the Pond was so much fun. I was joined by Megan Maroney and Jason Howell, who co-host Tech News Today on the Twit Network. Megan also co-hosts iOS Today, while Jason co-hosts All About Android. For an entire month, Megan and Jason swapped phones. They came to tell us what they liked, what they didn't like, and answer tough-hitting questions like, did your children mock you for using the other device? I know I say this a lot, but this truly was one of the most enjoyable episodes of Chit Chat Across the Pond. They're both so entertaining and delightful, and we even had some technical conversations too. Megan is especially my people. She is so sarcastic. I love her. Anyway, here's an inside secret. I very, very rarely listen to one of my own shows. I mean, you know, why would I? I was there the first time. But I smiled so much during this conversation that I listened to the entire show again the next day. It's that fun. Well, I have an interesting tech story to tell you about the recording of that episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond. I monitor my own voice using Audio Hijack, which is, and I never used to do that, but I started doing it a while ago when Dave Hamilton started talking about the importance of monitoring your own voice. It's important because if your own audio is screwed up, it's a lot easier to fix it before you record than it is afterwards. You can also hear if you're popping your peas too much or, you know, peaking in any way, that kind of thing. It's great to be able to hear it. And if you wait until afterwards, often you can't fix those problems at all. Well, when Megan got on the call originally on Skype before Jason arrived, I heard a fair amount of noise on the line. Megan and I did some experiments with me muting and then her muting, and we didn't find the root cause. Megan isn't an audio engineer, so she didn't have a lot of options on her end to fiddle with. She had a headset mic and, you know, I don't know, I didn't really want to bother her. I decided to proceed with the recording. Note to self, no matter how much it inconveniences your guests, it is worth it to fix it before recording. As we recorded, I realized the noise was only there when I was talking. Now, I think I do a pretty good job of letting other people talk when I interview them, a lot better than I am in real life, I assure you. But on this call, I had to cut that back even further because the noise was so annoying. A lot of times I wanted to jump in and say something and I would just sit there quietly, which I know Steve is going to say he doesn't recognize that in me. Maybe that's why the interview was so good. Anyway, when I went to edit the show, my voice was horrible. I mean, it was awful. It was almost unlistenable. So with dread, I split the track and I pulled my voice out and put it into another file so I could start doing some processing on my voice. Now, removing noise that's on top of real audio is a nightmare and always sounds bad. At best, you strive to make it listenable. At worst, you reach for less awful than it was when you started. So with dread, I started listening to my voice all by itself. But when I played it, it was perfectly clean. So get this, the noise was actually coming from Skype, but affected the recording only when I spoke. Now, this was actually terrific news. Because with most digital audio workstations, that's what they call, DAW is what they call audio recording software, like Amadeus Pro, the one I use, if you can get a clean sample of just the noise, the program can remove it everywhere. So all I needed to do was find a section where either Jason or Megan were talking, and then on my track, when Jason or Megan were talking, and then over on my track, sample that same section right below where they're talking, and tell Amadeus Pro, sample the noise. Then I was able to select the entire track and select remove noise. Boom. My track sounded perfect. Their track sounded perfect. No noise at all. The lesson here is, there's several of them. Always monitor your own voice. Fix things before you record. Record yourself on a separate track from the other person whenever possible. And hope for the best. Well, let's get going with the very last three of the CES interviews that Steve has done such a great job of producing. A lot of great products come when somebody scratches their own itch, and Marcus Kukler from UDOC told a great story of why he's invented the UDOC.
Several times my kids took away my cables from my phone, and in the morning when I needed my phone, it was empty. So I searched and found a solution where the connector is inside the dock but still movable.
So I'm going to describe this a little bit for our audio listeners. We've got an aluminum dock here. It's got a nice slant to it. It's got a rounded area in front and a pivot on a piece on the back. And sliding along in a groove on it looks to be a lightning connector, right?
Exactly. We have lightning connectors. We have the old 30-pin connector. We have micro USB and USB-C. And all those connectors can be inserted here into that profile in any order and any number, of course.
So this is completely adaptable to any configuration of devices that you have, then?
Exactly. Whatever products you have at home, you can even configure it online and then get the right UDOC with the right connectors and the right length.
Okay. So he's sliding this piece up and down inside the cylinder. Why don't you pull that out and show us what else you can do with that? So he's got a plastic cylindrical piece in his hand with this connector sticking out.
That's actually the patent, is the cylindrical swiveling and sliding piece inside the rail, which is now applied in the U.S., in Europe, in Japan, and in China. And in addition to that, you can open this adapter, and you can raise this plug to absorb a bumper. So if you have a bumper, this plug goes now through the bumper.
Nice. Completely adaptable. So as you get a different case on your phone, you've got it, you can raise and lower that. That's excellent. Now I'm looking at this. You've got a small one here that looks like it maybe hold three phones, maybe four if they were cozy. And then I see one, he's got an iPad, a 12.9-inch iPad Pro, a 9.7-inch iPad Pro, and it looks like an Android phone plugged in next to it, room for one more phone. So you've got these in all different sizes depending on how crazy your devices are?
Yes. I mean, the beauty in this construction here is that you have an extrusion profile and you can cut any length you want. So if the market says we want this in 30 inches, it's no problem for us to adapt to that.
Oh, good point. I like it. You would be an engineer then.
No, I'm a product designer. I run a design company in Munich.
Oh, okay.
And for the last 25 years, we invented and designed for some large companies. And this one I did for myself because I was so bothered by my empty phones in the morning.
Oh, I can bet that. So they're captive now in this. That, you know, cleaning up the mess on our charging tables is definitely worthwhile. So I heard somebody earlier asking you about pricing. So these are already available?
We are available in Germany. I mean, we're sending from Germany towards the Europe countries. And this is available since 3 weeks.
It's our first in Germany.
In Germany, yes. Okay. So it's our first day in the U.S. and we are ready to ship in March.
Oh wow, fantastic! So you've got looks like four different models here. What's the price point and the sizes on these?
The shortest was 250 millimeters. I can't convert it into inches right now.
But, that's okay.
The 250 millimeters.
That's about 10 inches.
10 inches. 250 millimeter retails for $99. The 400 for $129. The 550 for $159, and the 700 for $179.
700 millimeters. I don't think even Steve and I need one that long. So what do you get with that? You get the extruded aluminum piece that's the dock itself, and then how many cables?
I mean, in this prices were four cables included.
Okay, do you get to pick which cables?
Yes. You pick, in a configurator, you pick the kind of cables you want, or you pay a ready set Apple version or Android version.
Okay, and you do need to use the UDOC cables because they've got the little notch, the little flange on it that goes in the notches in the patented piece. So nobody can give you use a cruddy cable and then blame you for it, right?
Exactly. That's why we made our own cables. They are certified from Apple, and so we assure that whatever you plug on works with charging and syncing.
This is a beautiful device. It's UDOC, UDOQ, and what's your website?
www.udoq.com.
All right, very good. It was very nice talking to you.
Thank you very much.
I really did think that UDOC was a terrific design. And like I said, it was the best example of how the greatest ideas are ones that scratch your own itch. I think the price does need to come down a lot, though. $100 to $150 for a piece of extruded aluminum and four cables, that's pretty steep. I was really kind of surprised at the price. I'm really glad they're selling Apple certified cables, though. That is important. But keep in mind, you wouldn't be able to add devices to the UDOC with your own cables unless you ordered directly from UDOC. You'd have to get them from them. So very cool design. I hope the guy can get the price down. I remember years ago, my good friend David Roth telling me how much time he spent trying to find the perfect Getting Things Done app. He realized that he could have been actually getting some stuff done if he hadn't spent all that time finding the right tool. He eventually just picked one and got on with his life. Well, I thought about that because I've been doing the same thing with text editors while learning JavaScript from Bart and programming by stealth. I tried out and abandoned 4 text editors before settling on CodeRunner. But it wouldn't be a No Silly Cast story if I didn't walk you through the problems to be solved and how I arrived at that decision, now would it? Well, I started with the free Text Wrangler from Barebones Software. My favorite feature is that it lets me log into my web server and edit files directly that are on my server. I use it all the time for editing my .htaccess file. That file's really important to you because that's the one that translates things like podfeet.com/Patreon into patreon.com/podfeet. So it's a really cool file, and it's really neat that I can edit that directly and I don't have to copy it down and put it back up. Text Wrangler also has text syntax highlighting, which is really, really essential. Syntax highlighting identifies variables and statements by a color. It does strings with another color, lots of other things. It really helps you find typos because if you misspell something, it jumps out at you because it's not the right color. In learning programming, it also helps me understand what's a real programming word and what's maybe a made-up variable. One of the hard things in programming is to remember to close your brackets, like parentheses, squirrely braces, that kind of thing. It's also hard to keep track of which ones start and end something. Like if you start one, you got to make sure you end it and make sure they line up and all that. In Text Wrangler, if you cross over, like say an opening one using the arrow keys to go past it, the matching brace will kind of briefly highlight. Text Wrangler also lets you fold up sections of code, which is pretty handy when you're trying to find and compare code from 2 different spots in your giant piece of code. I should mention that Text Wrangler has been deprecated by Barebones. It's not a bad thing, but instead they're now shipping their flagship product, BBEdit, with a free mode, a la Text Wrangler, and additional functionality for the paid-for product. It's pretty cool. So when it's free, it looks like Text Wrangler, but added functionality if you buy the paid-for version. And it's not like Nagware or anything. It's really, really well done. Well, I don't quite remember why I switched away from Text Wrangler, but I suspect Bart influenced me, because I started using the free Atom from Atom.io. Along with syntax highlighting, Atom automatically gives you a pair of brackets when you type the opening one. So let's say you want to make a variable b a function. You would type var space b equals function, and you would do open squirrely bracket. But when you type that first squirrely bracket into Atom, it adds the closing one for you automatically. Hit the enter key, and it auto-indents for you, saving time and making your code easier to read. Let's say you've gotten tangled in your brackets. If you cross over one with Atom, instead of just blinking once like Text Wrangler, it underlines them both. I like the way Atom handles this way better than the way Text Wrangler does. I like my code to word wrap on screen, not scroll off the page. In Atom, there's no keystroke to invoke a soft word wrap, and so I have to tediously go up to the menu bar and select it. I know it's a small thing, but it bugs me. I also found it tedious to have to select the language I was writing to make the syntax work properly before saving with a .js extension. Well, I briefly used the free COT editor, C-O-T editor, after Trevor Drover told us about it as a great simple text editor that opens up a blank window by default. I like this the syntax highlighting in COT editor, and I like that I could set my default file type to start with JavaScript too. COT editor lets me split the screen as many times as I want, and that easily allows me to compare code that's, say, at the beginning of the program to the bottom of the program. COT editor does bracket matching with a blink like Text Wrangler, but oddly, only shows you the opening one if you found the ending one. So moving across the opening bracket doesn't reveal the closing bracket. And if you're trying to say, did I close this? Well, you don't know unless you found it by yourself. Now that I knew it was possible to have an editor that adds the matching brackets for me, I couldn't deal with COT editor not having that function. I still use it a lot as a non-programming text editor, though. Having a plain text editor that launches with a blank file is just that much easier than any other text editor. Well, out of the blue, my buddy Niraj, I did not tell him I was looking for the perfect text editor, but remember my buddy Niraj? He used to be on staff here, but he got fired. Anyway, it was research assistant Niraj, but he stopped sending me stuff. Anyway, he recently sent me a note asking if I had tried the free brackets from brackets.io. By the way, have you noticed how many cool things are at .io? Lots of cool stuff's at .io. Anyway, it's called brackets. And well, of course, I'm going to try another text editor instead of actually working on my homework. I got more stuff to distract me here. I fell in love with brackets immediately. It had syntax highlighting. It gave me pairs of brackets automatically. It did the auto indent dance for me, but it did much, much more. I started to type something like function, and halfway through typing the word, it offered to autofill the rest of the word. I hit tab, and boom, it was written for me. Goodbye, typos. Well, if I create a variable, it turns out it shows up as an option if I start typing it too. So many problems eliminated. I would say like half of what I do is typos, of my mistakes anyway. But not half of everything I do, half of my mistakes. Anyway, but the real excitement was when I found out about JS Lint. Now, I'm not 100% sure and clear on what Lint is and why it's called that, but from what I can figure out, it appears to tidy up your code. For example, I'm not very good at indenting properly, so even with a text editor that does it for me, I manage to mess it up. Brackets will tell me things like expected line 8 to start on column 5, not column 9. I drive Bart crazy. When he looks at my code, if it's not indented properly, he loses his mind. So this was a great feature. But wait, there's more. It also found errors in my code. If I used a parentheses instead of a squirrely bracket, or I forgot an equal sign or used double equals when I should use triple equals, it would tell me I made that mistake. It was glorious. But there were a couple of problems. If you had too many errors, it would stop scanning the code. Basically, it would go, well, if you're not going to fix all that stuff, I'm not going to keep helping you. And one of the things it decided was an error, or lint, perhaps, was the underscore Bart has taught us to use to identify private variables from within a function. It also liked spaces between things like if and the first parentheses. So after 100 lines or so, brackets error checking would stop and refuse to go on. It's also not a normal app. For example, I can't open it using Spotlight. I don't really understand that, but I have to navigate to the applications folder and double click on it like an animal. I suppose I could put it in my dock, but I just don't use the dock for that. If its use of the file system is different, it's more like a file browser, I think is the way I would describe it. When you open a file, you see the entire folder in your left sidebar, and you can simply click on anything in that left sidebar, and you're viewing and editing the code. Kind of cool, but something to get used to. Well, I told Bart how enchanted I was with the error identification I was getting with brackets, but he was unimpressed. He said that delinting wasn't really debugging. I secretly think it was that he didn't like that it refused his precious underscores. Well, Bart went on for a hunt for something that would give us everything I wanted with no compromises. He found the tool called CodeRunner from CodeRunnerApp.com. It has the best features of all of the tools I tested and then some. I can prove it's great. It's the only one we tested that actually costs money, $15, and Bart and I both bought it. That really says something. So, what's to like? Of course, we've come to expect syntax highlighting and auto opening and closing of brackets and auto indenting. But CodeRunner takes it up a couple of big notches from there. Remember how some of the editors had autofill? CodeRunner not only does that, but offers to write out the entire function, including placeholders for what you need to supply. Let me explain by example. A good friend of the show, Jill, has been teaching us about test-driven development, or TDD. It's a way of writing test code where you compare the output of your code to what you thought would happen, and you include a text string explaining to yourself what you were trying to test. The built-in function in JavaScript is called assert equal. If you simply type the first couple of letters of assert, you can hit tab and it will automatically type out assert equals, open parentheses, actual, comma, string expected, comma, string message. Right there, I was ready to shell out the $15. But the best thing about CodeRunner is that you can actually run your code from right within the app. You do have to have the runtime environment Node.js installed on your Mac. Sorry, I stuttered over that. Node.js. You have to have that installed on your Mac. But luckily, we had done that earlier in Programming by Stealth. So picture this. I write a bunch of glop, I hit run, and a bottom panel slides up showing me where I screwed up. No delineating here. No delinting here. This is actually finding real mistakes. It will give me the line number, repeat the line for me, and point right at the character where it got confused. I can't tell you how many urgent text messages Bart and Dorothy have not gotten from me because CodeRunner found my mistakes. On the CodeRunner site, they show the ability to step through your code to debug, but as of version 2.2 that's available right now, That feature's not available for JavaScript, but I'm looking forward to it in a future update. CodeRunner, as near as I can find, doesn't have a way to split the screen to view two parts of your code. I've gotten in the habit now of opening a new document and pasting in the code I want just for reference. It's kind of a workaround to be sure, but as long as I remember it's not the real code, it seems to work okay. Another thing to like about CodeRunner is that it's customizable. Don't like auto opening and closing of brackets, indenting in new lines, or syntax highlighting? You can shut that off in preferences. Hate autocomplete as much as I love it? You can shut that off too. Lines wrap by default? I love it, but if you hate it, turn it off. I'm not a huge believer in auto-saving and versioning, but CodeRunner supports it by default, and you can turn that off too. Some days I love a dark interface, but sometimes it gets on my nerves. CodeRunner has tons of themes, and you can even customize and make your own. CodeRunner is available through the Mac App Store, but because of sandboxing, you can't run via Node.js in that version. Luckily, the developer, Nikolai Krill, gives an easy way to convert your license to the non-App Store version. I have to say, though, if I had to do it over again, I'd buy directly from the developer so he would get the full $15. CodeRunner has almost everything I want, and it was well worth the $15. Only downside is that now I have to go work on my homework. You may have noticed that there are no ads in the NoSillaCast or in Chit Chat Across the Pond. This show is funded only by our Amazon affiliate links and by people like you who go to podfeet.com/Patreon and pledge a dollar amount for every NoSillaCast we publish. Tim Jarr and Rick Cartwright just signed up this week to pledge their support. While I was over there thanking them, I was perusing the growing list of patrons and realized I never thanked Valerie Quinlivan for her support, and she was one of the very first people to sign up on Patreon. I'm so sorry I missed you, Valerie, but thank you, definitely thank you. I can't thank all of you enough, and I hope to continue to live up to the value you hope to get from the show. All right, let's hear now from one of the most enthusiastic people we interviewed at CES.
I'm with Hongbin Zhuang of Emotech, and we've got something here that looks sort of like a donut on the table. It's black. It looks like it's got a little camera, but every once in a while it stands up and it rotates around, and it's got lights coming out of it. What is this?
So this is Ollie. It's the first robot that adapts its personality to each individual. And it serves as a personal assistant at home. And it controls your smart home devices and organize your schedule and learns your habits and preferences, and then it can proactively interact with you to make your life easier.
Okay, so you were explaining to me before we start rolling tape here that Ollie actually learns. It's interactive and it starts to learn you.
Yeah, so it recognizes everyone based on do facial recognition, and after that it kind of learns the preferences and habits from everyone.
Now that's interesting. Like, what would be an example of what you could have it do?
So, for example, everyone have different personality. Everyone have their preferences on music, on movie. Everyone have different lifestyle. Yeah. So the system, first of all, I got a user identity, and then based on the interaction, I know when is the right timing to do what kind of task for the.
So, like you said, if you come home and you always want the lights to come on, it learns that that's what you do, or it learns what kind of music you like, and it can learn different people.
Yes, yes. So, because it recognizes you by your face and also your voice.
Oh wow! Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So I mean, every time you interact with it, and the system will learn. And then when it realizes, okay, every time when you come back home, you will play jazz, let's say, or someone may prefer rock and roll, and then, yeah.
Oh, that's very cool. So when will Ollie be on the market?
Pretty soon. So now we are in beta version. So we will deliver a few hundred to early adopters just in April 17th. And then probably August or September, we're going to launch to the market.
Very good. And how much do you expect Ollie to sell for?
So we haven't put the accurate number yet, but based on our user research, people are expecting that the range between 600 to 800. Yeah.
Okay, very cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much as well.
A few weeks ago, I talked about the long adventure I'd been through with Lawrence from CrashPlan trying to help me adopt my offsite backup from my 2013 MacBook Pro to my 2016 MacBook Pro. I explained that he'd worked really, really hard, but never could get a backup running for me. I tested out Backblaze and found that in just 18 hours, it had successfully backed up my new Mac. I gave Lawrence the link to the blog post I wrote about what happened, and you would think the story would end there. But you would be wrong. Lawrence kept working on my backups. I was ready to give up, but he was not. He eventually handed me off to a guy named Brandon. Brandon went on to great lengths to make sure I understood that everything Lawrence had done was right and that he had not made any mistakes. But Brandon did one thing completely new. He asked to talk on the phone with me and to use screen sharing. Now, I had thought partway through my long relationship with Lawrence, I mean, we've been together for months now. I thought, you know, a phone call would speed up our understanding. But, you know, like any good little nerdlet, I try really hard never to talk on the phone. Well, my curiosity was piqued and I decided I would agree to talk to Brandon. As much as I like to drag out a story, I'm going to give you a spoiler before I drag out the story. In a couple of hours of working on my backups and a couple of days to allow some maintenance to run on CrashPlan's end, I have working backups on CrashPlan. Now, I'm sure you're saying to yourself, oh, I would have abandoned this long before that. But what I learned from Brandon during this process is really, really interesting. Let me explain what Brandon and I did to tailor my backup first, and then I'll read you his explanation of why we had to do this. Then I'll explain to you why you really do care about this if you're a Backblaze customer. In the CrashPlan software, Brandon had me modify what files could be excluded from my backups. I had chosen to backup pretty much every single doggone file on my Mac. I thought that's what I was supposed to do. Well, he started in the system library and he had me uncheck it at the top level, so nothing in the system level library would be backed up. So you know how I always say to clean your closet, you have to remove everything and only put back what you need. That's why you should do a clean install on your Mac. Well, Brandon believes in that too. In fact, when I told him this was a clean install, he said, I love you, man, because people always bring along all this old crud and I don't. Anyway, that's why we started working on my system library that way. We turned everything off and said, we're only going to turn on what I do need backed up. Now, he emphasized in this process constantly that I could put back anything I thought I needed. I'd say, well, you know, I kind of want, he goes, check it. You can have it. He wasn't trying to keep me from doing anything, but he was super knowledgeable about which files were things like cache files or app generated files that would be reproduced when those apps got reinstalled after a catastrophe. In the system library, the only thing I had created myself were some filters to create smaller size PDFs with good quality images. By the way, I have a tutorial on that, of course, and there's a link in the show notes. We then followed the same process in my user library, and there we found a few more things of interest. In particular, many applications store files inside your /application support folder. I remember ages ago, after I'd done a clean install, I discovered that my database of all my DVDs was gone. I store them in the awesome DVD PDF from Brugy.com, and it turns out they store the database inside that application support folder. Luckily, I had an old local backup that still had that file. Well, we start going line by line through the application support folder because of this. Audio Hijack stores your session files as plists in there. Clarify stores your custom-made templates in there. Feeder keeps my podcast feed files in there. Hazel, Marzedit, Nicecast, SuperDuper, Telegram, TextExpander, Transmit, and Auphonic Leveler all keep tailored setting files in there. Sure, I could reproduce them, but Brandon said, no, back them up so you don't have to. Well, while I was writing this up, I realized I have another question for Brandon. If I had a new application and it stores files in the application support folder, I'm not actually sure whether CrashPlan will back it up by default or whether I have to specifically add it back in. That's going to be hard to remember to do if that's true, so maybe I'll be allowed to back up that entire folder. I sent an email to him, but he doesn't work the weekend, so when I find out, if you guys care, I'll let you know. Well, it sounds like I've listed a ton of stuff to keep, but there was so much more in there I didn't need. For example, the mobile sync folder is in your user library. That's where Apple stores the backups of your iOS devices. Surely there's no reason that I would need to back up those files up to an offsite backup service. I mean, I could, but it was tens of gigabytes, so I don't care about that. That was probably not one of the files that was causing problems anyway. Well, we also took a stroll through the user library containers directory, and I chose to keep a few directories in there as well. I did a little bit of research on the containers directory, and it seems that some companies keep their databases in there. For example, I found that Things and OmniFocus both keep their databases in containers. Definitely good to take a look in there. So I promise to get back to Brandon's explanation of why this tedious task was necessary, but I want to bring Backblaze into the story first. I got an email from Lewis Butler pointing out that Backblaze doesn't back everything up. He didn't elaborate, so I did some more investigation, and I found some interesting bits of information you might find useful in making your own offsite backup decisions. Let me read the explanation of excluded files from Backblaze's website. They say, Backblaze does not want to waste your bandwidth or Backblaze data center disk space. Thus, we do not back up your operating system, application files, empty folders, directories, or temporary internet files that are transient and would not be useful in the future. You can see these exclusions by tapping on Settings in the Backblaze control panel and selecting the Exclusions tab. Well, Lewis Butler also later pointed out that there are some directories that if you're an Uber geek, like many of us, that you might care about. Things like /etc and /sbin and more are in that exclusions list. I'm not sure why CrashPlan does back up your applications, but Backblaze specifically prohibits it. You cannot modify that exclusion list. However, Backblaze does have a list of file types that they also don't back up, but that you can actually override. For example, if you like to save disk image files, either ones you've made yourself or, say, application installers, you have to remove .dmg from the file type exclusion list. It's cool that you can remove the exclusion, but if you don't look at that list carefully, you could get a very sad surprise. I know people make encrypted disk images, their sparse image bundles, on their Macs to store sensitive information, so that would be a pretty unwelcome surprise if you didn't pay attention while backing up to Backblaze. One of the great things about working with Brandon at CrashPlan was that he was more than willing to explain things to me. He's pretty verbose. In fact, instead of parsing all of the conversations we'd had myself, I asked him, would you just explain what you did and why in a couple of paragraphs? It's a little long, but I think it's interesting, so I'll read you the whole thing. So Brandon from CrashPlan wrote this. Though we are unlimited in terms of archive space, we are not built to back up everything that people keep on their machines. Specifically, CrashPlan was not designed to back up system, application, temp, cache, log, etc. kind of files. As such, when those file types are included in one's file selection, due to the rapidity at which they change, usually, they start to fill up an archive, not in size just as much as sheer number. For you, he's talking to me, there were literally millions of these files floating around in your archive dating back to 2013, many worthless in terms of restore purposes. Again, archive size not really being an issue, CrashPlan had to keep track of all those files. The kicker for you had to do with CrashPlan also having to track the versions of all those unnecessary files. This effectively swelled your archive's index file, i.e. the files that keep track of all the stuff, to many times the normal size. Think about a 3 to 4 gigabyte text file that needs to be transmitted between our server and your client and traversed for the purpose of deduplication and retention purposes. So that's not real data. This is me talking for a moment here. That's not real data. This is a 3 to 4 gigabyte text file that's just saying, here's all the file names. Go check and see if you've already got them. That's a lot of work. Needless to say, the things can still work for you, sorta. It does create some mode of a bottleneck so that normal things like archive maintenance can't take place or be effective as they should be. The fix was simple. Scale back your versioning a bit. That was another change we made. Remove all of the system, application, temp, cache, log, etc. files from your archive, then push it through archive maintenance to pull that data out of your archive. You were fixed when this process completed. The rest was just the initial backup of your new machine. Okay, I thought Brandon gave a great explanation. With literally millions of these little tiny files that no one cares about, the process of comparing every single one to what I have now just to figure out what to back up was taking so long that the backup simply never could start. This was exacerbated by the fact that CrashPlan checks newer, smaller files first and newer, larger files second. Then it moves on to the older, smaller files and then the older, larger files. So these newer, small files and large files, that would include all of these silly little changing cache files that I had. So let's see if we can wrap this up with some conclusions. First of all, I give CrashPlan huge props for staying with me on this. They dedicated an enormous amount of time to me and even kept going after I kind of slammed them in my blog post. I mean, I try to be polite and professional, but wasn't exactly a glowing report. They stayed head down committed to getting this fixed and were never distracted by other events. CrashPlan backups everything you ask it to back up, even stuff that doesn't make sense to back up. So you can ask it to do whatever you want. Backblaze, on the flip side, restricts what you can back up. I'm not sure which is actually a better way to go. Perhaps CrashPen could be a little more verbose in their backup tool. Like if it had suggested to me that perhaps you should reconsider backing up your entire system-level library, then, I probably wouldn't have done that in the first place. Then again, I'm a geek and I can understand the repercussions of those decisions, and most normal people wouldn't be equipped for that, so maybe that's why they don't do it. Now, Backblaze does have way faster backups. From my experience, the process is unrestricted by anything other than your own upload speeds. CrashPen is, in contrast, will allow only 10 to 30 gigabytes a day, he said, maximum, depending on what's going on the server. You're not going to get faster than 30 gigabytes a day. For most people, that's probably enough. And for incremental backups, it's even enough for me. But that first backup to CrashPen did take 3 weeks, where it took Backblaze a mere 18 hours. Now, remember, once my backup started running and working properly after all of Brandon's hard work, it only took, like a day and a half, maybe a day. It wasn't very long for it to catch up for those months and months and months that this hasn't been running. So the main conclusion I've come to is that both CrashPen and Backblaze are great services with pros and cons. The good thing is that we have competition and we have two excellent, excellent choices. And I do want to close by again thanking both Lawrence and Brandon for their commitment and help. I don't personally have any trouble with air quality, but I know that for many people, air purification can make a huge difference in their lives. Allergies or whatever, I know it can be a big deal. Let's hear now from Wind, W-Y-N-D, about their portable smart air purifier.
You might be lucky enough to live in a country or in an area where the air is always pure, there's no pollen, you never have any allergies, but there's a lot of us who live in areas where that is a big problem. There's a lot of countries that are having trouble with air quality, and a company called Wind, W-Y-N-D, is aiming to try to help you create a bubble of pure air just for yourself. And I'm here with Raymond Wu from Wind, and he's going to tell us about that.
Thanks. So I'm Ray, and the Wind product is actually two parts. We want to clean your air, so there's a purifier. You can turn it on, and basically by spinning the top, you can control the level of airflow.
I'm going to explain a little bit for the audio listeners too. So he's got a cylinder that's maybe 8-10 inches long, a couple inches in diameter, and he's turning the top of it. It's got a nice blue light, and there's a fan blowing air out of it.
Yep. And inside's a medical grade filter that filters out anything from allergens to pollen to pet dander, all the way down to the size of very tiny particles such as car exhaust, industrial pollution, and even bacteria. And on top of the purifier side of things, we wanted to give people insights about the air quality because air is mostly invisible. So how do you know when it's bad or even getting better? And so we basically invented our own air quality monitor.
So he just pulled a small chunky piece out like the size of a car fob out of the bottom, and that piece is called the
air quality tracker. And we invented it because we saw that air quality monitors out there are really big and expensive, and they shouldn't have to be. We wanted people to get insights about the air quality without having to spend a lot and having something that's so small they can carry it around with them if they wanted to. So this is the size of my thumb, and if you wanted to, you can bring it with you. It has a week-long battery life, and it'll give you insights about the air quality, what you're breathing. And then when you need to, you can take out the purifier. It's almost like a big brother, and they work together to basically monitor and then clean the air automatically.
I'm wondering, how is my office? I don't know whether, I've been sneezing a lot or my nose is dripping. What is it? What's going on? Is there something in my office? You could carry that around, monitor it over time. And how do you get the data off of this? Where does that come in?
So we use Bluetooth low energy. It's very safe, and it basically connects to your phone, and the phone aggregates all that and interprets it for you. And we have a good set of designs to basically make that very transparent. So it'll tell you, for example, today we filtered out this much pollution. It's equivalent to you not breathing in this many cigarettes.
Oh, I love it. I love it. So you put it in a metric we can understand.
Yeah. And then on top of that, we know Wind is designed initially for kind of a personal experience. It's for your own air quality. It's for your own sensing and purification. But on top of that, when we have all these sensors deployed, we want to create a ways of air quality. And so today at CES is the first time we're debuting this. It's actually the first crowdsourced air quality, ever with mobile sensors. And And what I'm showing you here is
he's got a display map of Las Vegas, and there's a bunch of little dots, and a lot of them are blue with little numbers on them, like 17, 19, 21. We see some bad ones, though. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so we had users, basically customers, walk around with these sensors, and they went into casinos, they were outside, they were at the airport, and they were collecting data for themselves, but also for the whole community. And here we're showing you all of the data that was collected just in one day, and you can see some places are very clean. The circles are very blue. There's a number in there called the air quality index. It'll be a very low number if it's clean. But there's some other numbers that are purple or yellow or orange, meaning that those areas were not very clean.
I do not want to go to that 450. That is not a good place to go.
That looks like it was very bad. Maybe there were people smoking. It was a smoking lounge or something. But when we get this density of data, we hope we can give a lot more insights to people about how to keep themselves healthy.
So there's a crowdsource piece to that, and you, as a member of the Wind community, you get access to this data?
Yeah, actually, that data is free for everyone. We have an app called Air Bubbles. It's for iOS and Android, called Air Bubbles, and it shows air quality from all around the world. But when we get our devices deployed, the actual hardware, we're going to add to that, and it's going to create much more insights than what we have already.
So you've got metrics, real honest-to-God metrics. You can really see what you're doing and understand, and a device that's beautiful. It would look gorgeous on a desk. It's white. I see you have a black one as well. It's got the pretty blue light. Everybody loves the blue light on top. You know that. You can change the volume of the air being blown at you in the purified form. It's got a little kickstand. This is a beautiful product. It looks like it solves an interesting problem, and I love metrics. I'm a crazy person for metrics. When do you expect the Wind to be available?
It'll be available in April, and it's available already right now for pre-order on our website at hellowind.com.
So HELLOWYND.com. And how much are we talking?
$154 for the pre-order, and it'll go up to $189 for the retail price.
That is not bad at all. That's pretty impressive. Well, this is fantastic. Thank you very much, Ray. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Allison.
Well, that's going to wind us up for this week. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com and follow me on Twitter at podfeet. Remember, everything good starts with podfeet.com/something, podfeet.com/Patreon, podfeet.com/Facebook, podfeet.com/Google+, podfeet.com/Amazon. That's a really important one. And if you want to join in the fun of the live show like Daniel did the last 2 weeks in a row, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.